Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Good morning, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure. I'm here at Three Sticks Adobe. It's a really quite a charming oasis in Sonoma. If you guys haven't checked it out, please change that because I think you will be enthralled. And I'm here with very special people today. Ryan Pritchard, who's a winemaker at Three Sticks, and Bob Cabral, who is a director of winemaking. You might know him from William Selyem, a venerable brand that really is a reference point for Pinot Noir in California. Welcome. It's really good to have you both.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you. And we'll start with getting to know you personally a little bit. Just, you know, the bio data. Where were you born? Where'd you go to school? And, okay. I know you guys have some history together that I'm really excited to unravel because you worked together in the past. Mm-hmm. But we'll start with just individual information so we can tell our listeners where it all began for you.
Well, so this is Ryan Pritchard, and I was born in Berkeley, California, so not too far away, not quite wine country, but close proximity. So I grew up sort of close to wine, but wasn't a winemaking family. I went to Berkeley High, ended up going to Cornell University, which is where I really sort of fell in love with wine. Mm-hmm. There's a wine appreciation course at Cornell in their hotel school, and it was, you know, all the seniors take it. It's a pass-fail class. Everybody, it's probably the most failed course at Cornell.
Oh my.
And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful sort of introduction into wine. We taste a different region every week and get to, you know, we learn about it, taste through sort of inexpensive examples of that, all the way up through really expensive versions of that. So alumni have gifted wines from their cellars to this program, and we get to taste through those. So that was kind of my first aha moment, and, and I knew I really loved wine and wanted to learn more about it. So I came out of school. I was an engineer by trade and went and worked for a management consulting company and got to travel a lot and got to taste wines at events and things like that. And I just wanted to learn more and more about wine. So I started making it on the side. I took a wine certificate course at UC Davis while I was working in Colorado at the time. Mm-hmm. And started making it in our second bathroom. My wife would always, harvest time would come and she would know that we couldn't have guests over overnight because we'd have fermenting grapes in the shower stall. So that was always fun. And eventually, while I was taking that class, I decided this is something that I spend all my free time doing. It's something that I would, you know, I'd be up at 2 a.m. to take this test, which the grades really didn't matter, but I was just so interested in understanding more and learning more about wine that it's something that I knew I wanted to do with all of my time. So moved out to California, or moved back to California, as it were. Started working with Bob at William Selyem as an intern, and that was such a great experience for me because it got me to really understand how my first real foray into full-time winemaking, and to learn it at such a precise and really the sort of the epitome of how you really should do it. I didn't have any bad examples in those first years, so
that he can remember.
But so that was the beginning, and then I worked at a couple of other great places along the way, and was at Copan Custom Crush, learned with a bunch of other winemakers. We worked with 25 different winemakers, sort of a custom crush facility, mm-hmm. so we were all sharing the same equipment, and providing the equipment and labor and whatnot. And so I really got a chance to work with a bunch of different people and see how it could be done differently as well. Then went on to Medlock Ames. I was there for a number of years, working with one vineyard, one site, and and then had the opportunity to come back and work with Bob at Three Sticks. It was sort of a dream come true, get back into Pinot Noir and Chardonnay heavily, and here we are.
How'd you get such a cool internship? I'm sure a lot of people want to know, how did you land in like the top spot right away?
I got really lucky. I think, I know now, when we look for interns, it's difficult. It's a challenge to find people and to find good people. So, we always look for people who have passion for winemaking, have really good attitudes and who can work hard. So, we'll pull people in from, who have a history of working farming, or it's really an intern. We're trying to teach them how to do it the way we want them to do it. Yeah. So you don't have to have years and years of experience to come in and be an intern. You can just jump in if you have a good work ethic and are willing to clean a lot and follow the precise directions. You can be successful. So.
Well, you heard it here first, you guys. You have an opportunity to actually, if you're really passionate, like Ryan clearly was, you're a bit of an alchemist brewing in your bathtub. But right. You took it a whole lot further, and you, from what sounds like, had forsaken, a corporate career.
I did. Yeah, it was, financially, it was a difficult decision.
Yeah,
I think
sure.
When I was
still is.
No, it's. I remember talking with them when we first were on the phone doing the interview, and they, are you sure you know what you're doing? Is this? Are you sure this is? You're going down and, working at that time, it was probably $12 an hour or something. It was a real sort of starting over. But I think that's really the best way. You have to do it that way to see all those pieces. You can't just jump in and start. Thinking exactly what to do. You may think you do, but you get in and you learn a bunch of new things when you're doing it as a real profession and doing it in a very specific and sort of the highest end. So
did you ever have a moment when you asked yourself, my God, what have I done?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But I can honestly say that it's been the best decision I've made. There have been hardships and things that I've given up for sure. But I don't come to work ever feeling like it's work.
That's a big statement.
I show up and it's what I love to do. So you can show up and see all the people in the cellar, and it's just a fun week every week to come in and make wine. And it's a lot of hard work, and there are challenges for sure, but I'm very glad I made the decision.
You don't look unhappy to me at all. Your eyes are smiling, so I think that says it all.
I think the one time a year you question it is bottling.
Yeah, bottling.
Bottling.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's a doozy, huh?
It's just so many pieces coming together. Yeah. We can expound on that.
Oh, yes. No, that's definitely, I'm making a mental note. We'll get into bottling conversations. So, Bob, where are you from?
So, I grew up, I was born in Fresno, actually, and then grew up pretty much about 120 miles north. So, kind of north of Modesto, northeast of Modesto in a little town called Escalon. Mm-hmm. My dad grew up in Ripon, Manteca area. And my grandparents farmed grapes and almonds, and my dad had a farm management company, so I grew up on 70 acres outside of the town of Escalon. I have an older sister, younger sister. I did a lot of the agricultural things as a kid. I participated in 4-H and raised animals and future farmers, judged livestock. Was on like a vine pruning team, those kinds of things that you just did that were just part of normal life around being in that agricultural setting. So when it was time to go to college, I at one point contemplated becoming a veterinarian, large animal vet, and I worked for a vet one summer, and just various things. I decided that I didn't want to go to school for 8 more years, to get a doctorate in veterinary medicine. And at that point then said, well, maybe I'll try winemaking because it was a heavy science base mm-hmm. kind of thing. And I'd applied to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, Fresno State, and UC Davis, and got accepted at all three schools, and chose between Fresno and Davis primarily because Cal Poly didn't have a mm-hmm. winemaking school, which kind of bummed me out because Davis and Fresno were still in the Central Valley, and I kind of wanted to get out to the beach. Would have been nice. So I ended up, my dad was a graduate of, at the time it was called Fresno State College, mm-hmm. and there was kind of an ongoing joke in our family that if we went to my dad's alma mater that he would pay for school. Well, anybody that knows what red wine grapes were selling for in the mid to late 70s, my folks didn't have any money to send me off to college. So yeah. I kind of relied on scholarships and student loans and things like that, but ended up at Fresno State ultimately to okay. do my undergrad in fermentation science. Mm-hmm. I worked for wineries down there. I grew up with the Gallos and the Franzias and the Delicatos out of Manteca. And, ended up working at Bronco Wine Company during my undergrad as a field man. So I checked grapes primarily from Modesto to Tejon or Bakersfield. Mm-hmm. And that was a great experience because I got to see a big, broad spectrum of grape growing and varietals. And it was really an ongoing educational process for me. After I finished my undergrad degree, I went to work for a large winery called Vidal. We made a lot of wine for other people. We also had stills, so we made brandy and high proof. We had evaporators. We made grape concentrate. So I worked at a facility where I became the assistant winemaker right out of school with a capacity of about 13 million gallons. So it was a pretty large facility. And I worked there for 3 years. And decided that I needed to get out of the valley, and I had a lot of friends and classmates that were coming up to Napa and Sonoma. So this is about 1986, 1987. I'd been going to grad school studying biochemistry, and Vidal was paying for that. And so when I finished that coursework, I thought, okay, if I'm going to make the move, now's the time. So I moved up to Santa Rosa, or actually to Windsor, and became the assistant winemaker at Deloge Vineyards. And I did 6 vintages there. Went on to Kundi over in Sonoma Valley, and I became the custom crush winemaker there. So I had several clients that the Kundis, that I managed for the Kundis, consulting winemakers, Mary Edwards, Paul Hobbs, Steve McRosty, kind of my peer group. So wow. I learned a lot during those couple of years at Kundi about, like Ryan said, seeing how things can be done differently. You can take a different path and still end up at the same spot. Mm-hmm. Then I was offered a consulting job up at Alderbrook in Healdsburg through a vineyard manager I'd worked with at Deloge. Mm-hmm. And when I approached the Kundis and said, you know, could I do this kind of on the side, they really didn't want me to do that. They preferred that I just focused on their clients. So I went back to the guy and just said, you know, I'm gonna have to turn you down. And you know. So then he offered me the winemaker job.
Oh wow.
So that's kind of how that transpired. It was really kind of tough to leave the Kundis because I really enjoyed that family and they were just wonderful, wonderful people to mm-hmm. work for. So I worked at Alderbrook for 3 or 4 years, and then kind of got poached over to Hartford Court. Mm-hmm. I was making a lot of Zin, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay at Alderbrook. And I made the wines at Hartford Court for a couple years when I was offered the position at Williams Ellion. So that was around 1997, 98. And then I did 16 more vintages at Williams Ellion. Williams Ellion was a great career. We built a brand up. I built a new facility, purchased a couple of properties. So we actually owned some estate properties, planted them, made the first wines off of it. But we just continued to grow. And yeah. it was something that I didn't want to keep doing. It wasn't that I thought it was bad. It was just something personally I didn't want to do. And so it was time to make a change. So that's when I decided to leave Williams Selium at the end of 2014. And I had kind of this employment contract up until then. And during that last year, it was announced, I think, in February or March of 2014 that I was going to leave Williams Selium. And so it was very humbling that the phone started ringing. And I, one of the first calls, actually it was an email from Bill Price. Just wanted to know if I wanted to have dinner. So we had dinner at Zazu in Sebastopol and just talked about, you know, the projects he had going on. He owned these great vineyards. He owned Gap's Crown at the time. He had owned Durrell. He was looking to purchase some more sites. And we just kind of stayed in touch. And meanwhile, I talked to maybe a dozen other people after that about various projects. And finally settled on Three Sticks when I heard that Ryan was coming. They were going to hire him as the assistant winemaker. And we wanted to take the project kind of from a little bit of a hobby, what it really was to start with, to a business. Could we get it to a viable business? And that's kind of where we're at now. We're just still kind of in a growth phase. And
it's absolutely fascinating to hear you talk about going from large-scale operations to like ultra-premium boutique, especially at the time when you joined those companies. Was it a logical, in terms of the actual logistics of the job transition? What was it like?
You know, it's funny. Like Ryan said with an intern, we're going to show you how we want things done. So, you know, going from a large multi-million gallon facility down to 60 gallon barrels, for me, wasn't that big of a transition. The industry had a hard time with it. I did a lot of interviewing up in Napa and Sonoma. And they just didn't think I would be able to make that transition. The one winemaker told me that I should just keep my job down in the valley and not worry about coming up here. That was in Napa. I got another letter from a Napa family that I still have that said, this is a family operation. It will always be a family operation. You need never apply here again. And I thought, I'm just looking for a harvest job kind of thing. But that was a little bit of the response I got. And in the mid-80s, which was kind of strange, I thought. So when I finally did actually get some offers, I was offered a job over at Flora Springs with James Hall was the assistant winemaker at the time. And actually Donald Patz was one of their sales managers. And I turned that down because it was just a harvest job, and Deloach was actually offering a full-time job at that time. So
it's disheartening to hear of the pessimism in Napa.
Well, and Sonoma too. There were a couple places in Sonoma that told me that we do things very on a much smaller scale. And you know, I think that winemaking or any job has a lot to do with the individual. Again, do they have the passion for it? Do they want to learn what needs to be done and how it is preferred done? And I just took that approach, you know. And there were times that I was like, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into? Randy Ellum was the winemaker at Deloach at the time. He's now head of all of Kendall Jackson. And Randy just, you know, he wanted everything done right all the time. I mean, I learned from, you know, getting to work with Paul Hobbs and Mary Edwards, I learned systems and methods.
Yeah.
With Randy, he taught me about the whole job, the business, managing people. You know, he told me many years ago when I first started, set a bar and then you develop people up to that bar, but never lower your bar. Whether you're making, back then we were making like a $7 bottle of white Zin. We used to sell like 30 or 40,000 cases of white Zin when I was there, and maybe 50 or 60,000 cases of Chardonnay, you know, at $12 a bottle. So Randy's whole thought was, you know, you always help people come up to your standard. Yeah. And some people aren't going to be able to do it. You know, it just, it's not a right or wrong thing. You just have to find people that are willing to put in the time and the effort.
Sage advice, and clearly it requires leadership qualities. I mean, I think most folks think of winemaking as a craft that mostly happens in the vineyard and the cellar, not the people business part of it, and mm-hmm. not the business part. But you clearly have stepped into those shoes very early in your career.
Yeah, I think I think life is a little bit about the people business. You know, I mean, in everything we do, you have to, even when I'm trying to advise my daughter when she's having difficulty either with an instructor at school or a subject or even a classmate, you know, is to kind of stop and take a step back and say, okay, if you were, wear those folks' shoes for a bit and take it from a different perspective. And then I think it gives you more perspective mm-hmm. and helps you to make better decisions on how you react to those people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I learned early on that you needed to have really good people surrounding you. And that's been a lot of my successes at all of these places. I've had a great career because I've had great people around me. And I think some of it by luck, and like Ryan said, you know, when we do look for certain traits when you're hiring people for internships or even permanent jobs, you know, I can teach you how to clean barrels, and I can teach you how to rack a tank and, you know, load a press, run fruit through a crusty stemmer, but I can't make people happy.
Yeah.
You know, they either have that demeanor. I can't make them want to learn.
Yeah.
I like inquisitive people, happy people. Like Ryan said, we show up. I love showing up at the cellar at Three Sticks because it's just so nice in the morning to see Hector and Kevin. And sometimes Carl's dog, Mel, is there, and he comes running up to you, and he's always so happy. And you know, when you, it doesn't feel like work when you walk into a happy place all the time.
I like that word, happy.
Yeah.
Well, by all accounts, the names that you mentioned, who were your mentors at the time, who's who, you know, particularly with respect to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but, you know, you very quickly became a reference point in people's minds, particularly maybe the demarcation is William Selling because it was such a cultish brand.
Mm-hmm.
But your talent, obviously, had been shining through, and over the years I've heard a lot of praise, and not just critics but just random peers that I talked to that spoke reverently of you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yeah, I William Selling was just, it was a great career there, and you know, I'm probably as proud or more proud of the people I worked with than necessarily the wines I made. And I'll be honest with you, and I've said this to Ryan, we've had these talks. I made wine out of fear for 17 years, and it was fear of failure. So a lot of my thought process was, what could go wrong? If it did go wrong, what was plan B or what was plan C? And I'm still a little bit in that mode, and I don't need to be in that mode. Because I didn't want to be the person that ruined William Selling.
Yeah.
I had been on their mailing list since graduate school, and I knew Bert, I knew Ed on a very personal level, and their names were on the label. And I just felt this sense of pride and ownership that I couldn't let them down. And I just didn't want the wines to suffer. Did they change? Absolutely, because no two winemakers make wine the same. And I wasn't necessarily trying to follow in his footsteps, but more shepherding the brand into the next phase of its life.
Yeah.
Which is what I told Jeff, who took over for me. Jeff Mangahos is now the winemaker over there, or director of winemaking, whatever his title is. And I just said, look, Jeff, don't get obsessed on what Bert did. Don't let people remind you all the time of what Bob did. This is what Bob did, or this is what Bert did. Do what Jeff needs to do. There's a good framework there. Stay within those parameters. You have the same vineyard sources, a lot of the same equipment, people, resources, and then put your handprint or thumbprint on those wines. Don't be afraid for a little bit of change. Just because I made them one way doesn't mean that it was the right way. And, you know, I think Jeff has done that. And he and I have had some talks, and I like the direction. You know, I wouldn't say they've changed dramatically, but subtly. Mm-hmm. And I think they do have Jeff's handprints on them now. And I'm very proud that he's been able to do that and not look back. Just keep moving forward.
That pressure that you put on yourself, you know, again, arguably, you should just, you know, be able to even dial it in at this point, just because you're so good and so experienced. But I'm not hearing even a whiff of that. Does that make you a better winemaker?
Well, I think that complacency can get you into difficult spots at times.
Yeah.
And to think that you that you know it all, you know, that I'm actually coming into my 40th vintage at a commercial winery, not as winemaker, but actually working at a winery in California. And I sometimes I feel like, and I really do believe this, that I know less now than I did even 10 or 20 years ago. And I equate that to just youth. When we're young, I think our enthusiasm, if you're smart, you don't think about too much of the minutiae or detail or what could go wrong. Maybe I thought about it at William Syme, but I didn't dwell on it. So when I did make decisions at William Syme, I mean, that was it. I made a decision and I moved on. Let the cards fall where they may. So it didn't keep me up at night. Well, it did for the first couple of years. But once I got into a groove, it was all about how could I make the grapes better? How could I make the wines better? How could we make this brand better? How could we really continue to leave our mark in the wine industry, and in particular the California wine industry? So,
yeah, and you were extremely generous. I'm sure as a mentor, and Ryan will probably attest to that shortly. But even I was a consumer at the time, and I don't know if you recall our meeting all those years ago when you were walking, you know, a group of us through the vineyard and showing how you taste. You know, you were talking about the seed and how it should taste ripe. I remember, and that was 15 years ago, but I remember very well just how open you were about your craft and how willing to share with people, you know, of what it's all about. And I think that's part of your success. You're so relatable.
Well, I was always so grateful that the winemakers I worked with were very much the same way.
Yeah.
I could ask Mary any question.
Yeah.
I could ask Paul Hobbs. I can call them to this day and ask questions. And I feel very fortunate. Like, you know, we've got this going on. What have you ever experienced something like this? And what would be a path that you might take? So I've always felt that that's important, that there really are no secrets to winemaking. Because the variables are immense.
Yeah.
We make wine in a big gray area. There's no black or white. Beer making, even distillation, there's a few more absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make a mistake today, a lot of times you can scrap it, do something different, but you can repeat the same process again.
Yeah.
With harvest, we get once a year. And you kind of have to take whatever Mother Nature's given you, and you've got to deal with it over a very short period of time. And you just learn to deal with it at that point.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.